Accession number 28776, rule 2.
Admiral Sir Raymond Ligo, reel 2. Admiral, could you tell me a little bit about how you taxi a Tiger Moth?
Well, the Tiger Moth had no brakes. It was a biplane. It was an airplane that was designed originally in the 1920s, and it had been in production some time before the war came. It had no radios. We had a thing called a Gosport tube, which was a pipe that you spoke into, and it came through your earphones. So it was a perfectly adequate means of communication, because there were two cockpits for the Tiger Moth. The instructor sat in the front, and the student, who was actually flying the aeroplane, and when you flew it solo, you flew it from the back. And you had a parachute to carry in those days, which was pretty essential to give you the height you needed to actually be able to see out of the thing. It had a throttle. It didn't, as I recall, have a mixture control. You went through the drills of vital actions as if you were flying a more sophisticated airplane. I remember those vital actions, those TMPFF, trim, mixture, pitch, fuel and flaps. And trim was a bungee on the elevators. It didn't have a floating tab, which you have in modern airplanes. You had a bungee. Funnily enough, the aeroplane I own now, which is a Cessna 406, has a bungee on the rudder control. It doesn't have a trimming tab, and the Tiger Moth. And so you had this ratchet thing, and it was two-thirds forward, I seem to remember, for takeoff. And trim mixture didn't have pitch, you didn't have fuel. Well, you had an indicator up top from the tank of fuel, which was on the upper wing. So it was a biplane, and the top, just over the pilot, shaped like a wing, was the fuel tank. And you could have a little ordinary kind of glass tube which showed you what the fuel level was. And flaps, well, you didn't have them, but you had the, what were they called? I've forgotten the name. These are leading edge flaps, which were, and they had a name, it's gone. And you had those unlocked or locked. If they were unlocked, then if the wing came up towards the critical angle, then as the pressure on the top of the wing moved forward, it would suck these flaps out, and that would help to smooth the airflow over the wing. And so there were little aerofoil sections which were fitted to the leading edge, but that's what they were. And you used them for landing, and you didn't use them for takeoff. You shut them down for takeoff, locked them, and then opened them as part of your landing drill for landing. It was a fabric aeroplane, of course, all fabric over wooden structure, and it had a Gypsy Moth engine, which was an inverted inline six-cylinder engine, and had two sets of magnetos, one and two. It had to be started by swinging the prop. You couldn't, they had no automatic way. The ground crew would swing it, and you had to make sure you had the chocks in case the aeroplane moved away and chopped them up in pieces. And so that was what it was. It sounded a very familiar note from the engine, it's a little tinny note. Because the interesting thing about it, and it's still true to this day, aeroplanes don't have silencers on them, you see. This is why they're so damn noisy. Why they haven't, the environmentalists haven't insisted that we all have silencers, because it does reduce the performance. But, it took off, I suppose, I'm guessing now, it's a long time since I flew one, about 50 miles an hour, I suppose. Miles an hour in those days, I suppose, 55, and you came into land at about 65, and we were taught always to do a glide approach and landing. So you came around the field at 1,000 feet, and you turn crosswind at 1,000 feet, throttle back, and the whole idea was that you would then glide in to the approach, turn on finals and glide. That's the way we were taught, not an engine-assisted approach and landing, which was a separate kind of procedure which we were taught. But primarily, you were taught to do a glide approach and landing, which meant that, of course, You were versatile. Well, you were trained, so if something went wrong and the engine stopped, you would know how to do a glide approach and landing into wind. So that was, and it was a nice little aeroplane. It was somewhat difficult to do aerobatics in, particularly a slow roll, because it would fall as you went over on the side. And years later, when I was instructing instructors at the Central Flying School, I remember a chap from Hampton, Flight Club Southampton, who was the instructor there with me, and said, "Look, Ray, I have terrible difficulty doing aerobatics in a Tiger Moth. Could you give me some private, kind of duel?" So I did. So it was obviously thought that I was quite capable of doing aerobatics in a Tiger Moth, which was not an easy aeroplane. Not in the roll, it wasn't. You had to use an awful lot of stick movement to keep it, keep the nose up on the horizon. Otherwise, the nose would fall through, and you'd finish up in a dive. But it was a nice little aeroplane. I mean, it was very basic, but it taught you all the things you needed to know. I mean, it had elevators, it had ailerons, it had these flaps of a sort. It was a fixed wing undercarriage, of course, and it was quite light on the controls. If you came in too fast and try to hold off, it would balloon, it would float, and so one had to, here we were all of 18, 19 years of age, and it wasn't a problem. It didn't seem to be a problem anyway.
If I could ask you something about, obviously, just flying a biplane of that sort. You did mention with the taxiing that it had no brakes.
Yes.
How would you control it?
Well, the way you had to put... you had to watch which direction the wind was blowing, because you had to hold your elevators according to, I'm trying to remember, into wind, you have the elevators pull the stick pulled back to hold the tail down. If you were turning downwind, you put the stick right forward again to try to keep the tail down. And you would, the only way you could turn it was to give a burst of throttle, full rudder, and hope it would go round. There was no other way it would go round, and that's where I got into trouble, because I thought I could turn it, but I couldn't. It didn't want to turn, and if they didn't want to turn, they didn't turn. Sometimes it was easy to go right through the rest of the compass. In other words, if it wouldn't turn to starboard, it's easy to turn it right round through port and go round that way. But you needed a fair bit of space, obviously, because you had no brakes. So when you wanted to stop, you just throttled right back. And of course, because you were on grass and the tyres were fairly soft, then you would come to a... you'd stop fairly quickly. But that's how you did it. Full rudder. You had to put full rudder on and a burst on the throttle, and that's where I got into trouble.
And with the aircraft, I mean, it's something as simple, say, as flying straight and level. Was there a... Did you have to work quite hard with that, with the aircraft being so light?
No, it was a very stable aeroplane. What you did have to do, and of course you don't have to do with more modern aircraft, although with my present Cessna 406, I have to use, in exactly the same way, you had to use the rudder to get the ball. In those days, you didn't have the needle and ball, which is the common American device for indicating whether you've got skid on one way or the other, or where your wings are, with the needle at the top. We had the British turn and bank, which was a needle at the top and a needle at the bottom, which showed you whether you were in a rate one turn. Now, to get into a decent rate one turn in the Tiger Moth, you had to put bank on, you had to put rudder on to get it to turn, and you had to put the right amount of rudder to keep the top needle straight as you went into the turn. Otherwise, you would either skid into the turn or slip into the turn. You skid out or slip. So that was the secret as to the great cry was needle and ball later on, because that was the American system. But with those, it was the same thing, except you had a needle at the top and a needle at the bottom. And so it taught you that you had to use stick and rudder to get the aeroplane into a turn, particularly with a thing like a Tiger Moth, which was somewhat underpowered. If you went into a turn and you weren't careful, you would lose height. So going into a turn, you needed stick, to bank to put on to start with, rudder to initiate the turn, and then keeping the stick back to keep the nose up, otherwise you would lose height. So it was a good aeroplane for teaching you the basics of how to fly, and nothing has really changed.
I was going to say, what was the cockpit instruments like?
Well, you had an airspeed indicator, you had a turn and bank indicator, which I've just mentioned. You had by this time an artificial horizon, so you had that. And what else would you have? Then you would have engine instruments. You would have a temperature gauge and an oil pressure gauge, and that would be about it.
Seems very basic.
It was very basic, but at the same time, absolutely correct in the way you had to fly that aeroplane properly. You couldn't kind of get away with being sloppy. It wouldn't accept that. It was a perfectly safe aeroplane with a very low stalling speed. You could spin it. You could spin it, and it would come out of the spin quite happily. So it was fully aerobatic. You could do loops. You could do roll off the top. You could do rolls, barrel rolls. Slow roll was the difficult thing.
And to the layman who doesn't fly, one of the things that seems most frightening, I think, is spinning.
Yes.
How are you instructed in
the spinning? Well, quite simply, very brutally, you first of all have been taught stalling and recovery from the stall, taking the engine off, pulling the nose up at a safe altitude till the aeroplane stalled, and then how to recover, pulling the stick forward, opening the throttle. You then had to be taught what was then called, I think, and still is, an incipient spin. That is to say, you went into the stall, and instead of recovering, you pulled the stick back instead of forward, and then one wing would drop, and the aeroplane would proceed to go into a spin. And you were merely taught that, and then the recovery was the same as any spin recovery has ever been. Stick forward, full opposite rudder, and you pull full opposite rudder and ease the stick forward. The spin would stop, and then you'd recover. The danger, well, not danger is not the right word, but one thing that could go wrong is that if you weren't fairly quick or well trained, then in recovering from a right-hand spin, you'd put on too much opposite rudder, go into a left-hand spin. So it was a question of, as she came out of the spin, right, centralise everything, if you like, take your hands off, and she'd pull herself out. The very safe little aeroplane.
And with coming out of a spin, would it only make one or two turns in a spin, really, the Tiger?
Yes, they do. I mean, the instructor would let you do two or three turns, depending on how much height you had, and then recover. And since most instructors, as I became an instructor, didn't want to make themselves feel any more ill than they already were going into spins, they weren't going to go in for unlimited spins because it was a bit sick-making procedure. So you didn't do too many before out you came. But recovering from the dive, of course, meant you pulled a few more G than you were used to doing. So it was good training practice.
You mentioned, obviously, that you'd done the kind of basics and then soloed. What was that experience of soloing? What was the procedure for soloing?
Well, it was solo. I mean, it was just like being a mouse in a cage, really. I mean, because you'd been taught to do circuits. Having done effective controls, the use of the throttle, stalls, spins, how to fly the aeroplane, you knew how to fly the aeroplane. Then they concentrated on the circuit. 1,000 feet downwind, turn crosswind, drill a vital action, shut the throttle, in you go, into wind to land. And so it was like a mouse in a cage, a trick that you've been taught to do with this circuit. So when you were sent for your first solo, what you did was you opened the throttle, took off and climbed to 500 feet, turn crosswind, climbed up to 1,000 feet, closed the throttle back to cruising speed, turned downwind, came downwind, did your drill of vital actions, turned crosswind, closed the throttle, and came into land. So it was a very, very straightforward procedure. They weren't having you go off and do anything on your first solo. Your first solo was solely getting round the circuit and landing, and that was it. You'd done it. Then you would go, your next instruction would take you a bit farther out into the more advanced aspects of flying the aircraft, and then when you went solo subsequently, you'd be told, leave the circuit, go and practice stalls, and then come back and join the circuit. So that's how you progressed.
And as a moment in your career, how did you feel with the first solo being completed?
I suppose I must have been fairly excited. I can't remember. I knew I was satisfied that I had done it. that was something else I could do. And that was it. It was all part and parcel of moving forward, really. Mind you, I didn't know what I was moving forward to, but I knew I was moving forward, so that was it.
And is there such a thing, obviously, to again, non-flying people, that you get a feel for an aircraft?
Oh, very much so. I mean, looking back on the Tiger Moth, it was a very sloppy aeroplane, really, because you had to use an awful lot of movement of the control column or the rudders to get the thing to work. Whereas if you were flying a Phantom or something, you could use very little stick and the aeroplane would go into a turn. You didn't have to use any rudder at all. I remember some years later, some chap asked me to go to the Army, Netherhaven, I suppose, wherever it was. There was a big procedure. I was then running British Aerospace, I suppose. And he said, I've got a big surprise for you, Ray. And there was a Tiger Moth sitting there. And he said, we'd like you to go off and do a circuit and landing. Oh, my God. The way these chaps think you can do all these things. And I got in this air, oh, Christ, that's what I never saw. The view was so bad. And I staggered round this circuit and this aeroplane landed. And I really didn't know what the hell I was doing. And it wasn't until I got out I realised there was no parachute. That's why I couldn't see. I was sitting so low in the damn thing, I could hardly see. And they must be joking. You know, you're off without a parachute. And anyway, that was, but that goes to show it was a very... It was an aeroplane that gave you a very good experience in the use of controls, because you had to use the controls.
And how did the pattern of training progress, obviously, after the solo? You said it became more advanced.
Yes, you then went on to do more interesting things. Aerobatics, for example, which you didn't do before. Stalls, spins, recovery on your own. Then you would do a little bit of navigation, and we had to culminate in a navigation flight, which was from Sealand to Elmden. And back again, and you had to join at Elmden and land there like a big sophisticated aviator. And then, of course, the interesting thing was when you got your flying gear, you'd often find that it was second hand. In other words, it had been used, and it had been used by somebody who had failed, because that's how the uniforms came. They came back, the flying suits, the gloves, the helmet, and suddenly you find yourself with some strange name already stenciled on it, and that was someone who had not succeeded. If you were lucky, you got new equipment, but quite often you got second-hand equipment. what was the equipment? The equipment was a flying suit, which was very necessary because, you know, you were an open cockpit, a leather helmet, Gosport tubes, gloves. You had silk gloves, and then woolen gloves, and then mittens, because it got jolly cold in the airplane. And then flying boots, of course, keep your feet warm. Trying to remember whether they gave you long underwear or not. I can't remember. They may have done. They may have done, because it got bloody cold. I mean, you needed everything you could get on, really. And so, anyway, that was it.
And at that stage, had you been practising forced landings at all?
Yes, that was another thing you had to do, was to go out and then pick a field and do an approach to it, and then open up the throttle and go around again. And then as you advanced, then the instructor would, without warning, cut the throttle on you and say, right, engine failure, now do me a forced landing. And then there were things called precautionary landings, which you had to practise, which you would have reason to land the aeroplane. The engine was still working, it was still functioning, but for some reason you had to land. So you pick a field and then you'd do a dummy approach into that field. By this time you were being taught to do engine-assisted approach in landings, which meant you used the throttle to regulate the amount of the glide path that you were actually achieving. to come nicely down into the field. And of course the amount of throttle you would use and engine would depend on the amount of wind there was. Unless, because you knew the wind was very strong, you'd come closer to the field so that when you close the throttle, she would descend fairly quickly. The other thing you were taught in those days, which has almost gone out of fashion, was side-slipping, where you'd put the top rudder on to hold the nose up, then put the stick over and the aeroplane would slide. And it was a good way of losing height rapidly. If you are doing a false landing, you found you were coming in too fast and too high, then you could perhaps side-slip the aeroplane to lose the height and then square it away when you got lower to continue the approach. So that was all part and parcel of flying training.
Would I be right in thinking at that stage they were trying to get you to be aware of always looking around at the ground should you have to make a false landing?
Indeed. You were really practicing airmanship. You were being taught to look out for other aircraft, to avoid them, to the rule of the air, which is the same as the rule of the sea, and to avoid other aircraft, the correct avoiding action, false landing, emergency procedures of all kinds, and aerobatics and spinning, and just being able to be in control of the aeroplane rather than have the aeroplane in control of you.
Were you able to do any low flying while you were at sea?
Yes, low flying was another thing that was practiced, and one usually enjoyed that, unless you got a bit too low. But that was interesting. And I remember, because when I was at the Central Flying School many years later, instructing on Tiger Waltz, I would go down into the Vale of Evesham, where we had a low-flying area, and in those days they still had steam trains, and it was quite fun low-flying alongside a steam train, because you were about the same speed that Tiger Moth, you know. So that was really fun. Those days, I'm afraid, have all gone. But you're quite right.
Is the sensation different with low-flying from the normal heights you were operating at while you were
training? Well, because the closer you are to the ground, the more you get a sensation of speed, as you have no sensation of speed. I mean, when you go up and fly and go through the sound barrier, which I did many years later, but I mean, there's no feeling of, except of course the compressibility, which affects the aeroplane as you go through. But there's no sensation of speed because you've got nothing to relate it to. You're in clear blue skies or above cloud, way up, and you just have no feeling at all. The closer you get to the ground, the greater the sensation of speed. And therefore, the kind of, to some people, it's a more thrilling experience. I mean, they do it because and chaps, you know, then go and do rather silly things, fly under bridges and various things like that, in order, you know, because they think it's very funny. I was much too professional, in a way, to do that kind of thing, because there are enough dangers in flying, as it were, without you inventing more, really, I always thought.
With low flying, I mean, did you have an area set aside for low flying?
Yes, there was always. Every airfield had a, I can't remember where it was at Sealand, it must have been over the Wirral somewhere. But yes, you'd had an area set aside, where the poor old inhabitants had to be used to aircraft whistling around over their heads. Of course, it's become more and more difficult, particularly as aeroplanes become more and more noisy and rather more frightening. I mean, you could hear a Tiger Moth coming and you could get out of the way, as it were, but with faster aeroplane, if it was over, you'd have told you before you knew it was there. So that became more difficult.
And again, slightly with low flying, are there any obstacles that you have to be aware of with your airmanship?
You had to be very familiar with the local area and with any obstructions that there might be. Pylons, electric cables, I mean, that was one of the classic examples. When I actually, at Leon Solent, many years later, when I was instructing in a Harvard, I was, the student was doing, he was doing stall turns and climbing up and then throttling back and wing over and stall turning. And we'd done one, and we're doing about 5,000 feet, I suppose, something like that. And I said to him, so we were down to about 3,000. I said, right, climb up and do another one. And he said to me, the throttle won't open. And I said, what do you mean? Grabbed hold of the throttle, and it was absolutely stuck closed, jammed. And we found out afterwards that the butterfly in the throttle had the backfire when he did the stall turn. It abrased itself onto the manifold itself, the induction manifold itself. And it should have been modified, and it was stamped as being modified, but it hadn't been modified. And so it just welded itself on, or brazed itself on. And I had to do a full standing in the Isle of Wight, can you imagine? There are no fields in the Isle of Wight worth full standing in. And so I picked one, and I said, right, you put out the maiden and tell everybody what's going on, and I will concentrate, because I was in the back, as usual, instructing. He was in the front. Yes, in the harbour, it was the reverse way around, that's right. And so as I came down towards the approach on this dreaded field, there was telegraph wires right across the approach. And then I discovered that it was uphill as well, which hadn't been visible, hadn't been clear to me. So I had a job getting the damn thing down over. Do I go through the wires? Do I go under the wires? Do I go over the wires? I went over the wires and banged that down. And as a result, because I was looking out at the side, because that's the only way I could see, I achieved this scar that's still there, another one on the back of my head there. My plane went backwards and forwards as we came to rest in the hedge at the far end. But this is the problem with false landings. I mean, it can look all right, and you can line up, and you can think it's all right. And it's not until you're actually on the approach that you actually know what kind of a place it is you're going into.
I take it from that then that the lay of the land looks very much different from the air then.
Oh, it looks much flatter than it is, unless it's quite rolling and quite obviously, you know, you're over valleys and hills, then yes, it does look much flatter. And it's only when you get low that you begin to appreciate that there are, in fact, that the field you've picked is either sloping away from you, which makes it much more difficult because you can't get the damn thing down, or it's going uphill, in which case you've got a problem because you might well go and make a very heavy landing indeed.
You've touched on failures within the course. What kind of rate do you remember of people who were failing at that early stage?
I would say on that early stage, I'm guessing now, 10 or 15% would fail. It wasn't a high failure rate. If you take the whole of the flying training, then the failure rate would be higher than that. It would probably be 20 or 30%, I suppose, in those days, before you finished and got your wings. But in the early stages, some chaps just didn't have the ability, it's no great virtue in it, it's just the ability to be able to judge and fly the airplane, and mostly, of course, fail because they couldn't land it, they couldn't get the landing right, and so it was too hazardous.
Would some of them lack really the hand-eye coordination that's needed for flying?
Yes, I mean, it was some had that. Most of those that failed were remustered as observers, and put on a course to go and become observers. Some, I suppose, if they said, no, I don't want to do that, would have to revert to general service. But that was the option. But it wasn't... it was always a frightening prospect. I mean, you're always worried about being scrubbed, as it was called. But, I mean, as I say, in the early stages, it's very difficult to my memory... to remember back how many people failed on my particular course, but I would have thought not more than 10 or 15%.